couple of years ago, there was a guy who was a, you know, he'd had a background, was an expert skydiver, and he joined a group of people that were going to do one of these crazy, you know, when you jump out of an airplane and then you're, you know, flying through the sky doing formations where, you know, you're grabbing hands with the people while you're falling at ridiculous speeds and, you know, doing like the old Sesame Street, you know, you're, let's make an A, then let's make a Z, you know, and all that stuff. And so he got all ready. He was going to be the cameraman. He got himself all ready. He spent a lot of time preparing. He was going to do a great job. He was really excited about the idea of jumping first. And then as he's kind of free-falling with this camera in his hand, he was going to, you know, watch, you know, and get this all on film as these people did this and then submit it, you know, and it'd be like on this, you know, all these TV shows about extreme sports. And so he was really pumped about it. And he got everything ready, and they were ready to jump. And so he took off, and then right after him, all these people came out. He's got the camera. He's all, you know, getting these great images. And this is all caught on tape, is that these people are falling, and they're doing all these, you know, forms. They get together and doing these stunts and spinning around. He's got all this. And then one by one, they start throwing up their parachute. And it was at this time that the videotape changed drastically. Because what happened was, on the videotape, all of a sudden you see this rattling and the thing begins to spin. And on the video, you just see this camera spinning. But the reason that took place is because the guy discovered a problem. He had spent so much time, this guy who was an expert skydiver had spent so much time getting ready for the camera shots and really getting pumped up that he forgot to put on his parachute. And at this moment of judgment, he realized that he was in dire trouble. And if I understand the story correctly, he did not get rescued. John is writing a book. This is a great book in the Bible that we're looking at. John is writing this book to us to make sure that we don't end up kind of in the same boat, that we're not going about life doing all this stuff of life, and even we may even be connected to a group, and we may even have some expertise in religion or not. But he wants to make sure that as we are kind of free-falling through life, that we have made, that we are totally sure that we have taken care of the most important thing. And that is our relationship with God, our relationship with Jesus. He fears that there will be people that he is writing to that will come to a point in life where it's too late to deal with it. And it will be at that point that they realize, hey, I don't have my parachute on. I never really trusted Jesus. There's a lot of things that can give us false assurance. You know, John, we've kind of titled this series of messages, a series of talks, Raise Your Hands If You're Sure. And the reason we've kind of given it that title is that this book, written by one of Jesus' best friends on the earth, he was a guy who hung out with Jesus, a guy who saw Jesus do everything that he did, saw all the miracles, he heard all of Jesus' teaching. And this one of Jesus' best friends is now writing a letter to people in a church that he had been with to make sure that they understand what real faith in Jesus really looks like and how it will act and how that faith is transforming. He wants people to make sure that they have taken care of the most important thing in life. Literally, what the book is a series of tests to kind of help us look and say, you know, I think I know Jesus. I think I've been changed by him. But as I wrestle with that, how does that really end up looking in my life? I think there's a lot of things that give people false assurance. This is a short list. I could talk about a lot of things, but let me give you a short list of things I think that people will trust in that will make them think, hey, my life's okay, when really maybe they've never given their life to Jesus, okay? One thing that might give people false assurance is a past decision. You know, at some point in time in my life, I may have, you know, been in a church and I may have decided, you know, hey, I'm going to pray that prayer with that guy, or I'm going to go forward into service. Or maybe you were hanging out with somebody who was religious and you kind of were like, you know, that's what I want. And because you at some point in time made this choice, hey, I'm going to make a decision to do something. It really wasn't a point in your life where you totally gave your life to Christ. You just had a religious decision. Like, okay, I'm going to be a good church person and I'm going to do the right stuff. Or maybe it's that, you know, you said, hey, I'm going to go pray that prayer and I'm going to do that thing and I'm going to make it all fit, okay? And you made a decision, but the truth of the matter is that decision has never had any real impact on the way you live your life and how Christ works in your life. But you're depending on that decision. I was in a hospital one time with a guy who was near the end of his life, and I kept asking him, hey, you know, you're wrestling with some life and death issues, do you understand what will happen to you after this life is over? And he said, no, I don't know what will happen. And I walked him through what it meant to really give your life to Jesus. He said, man, when I was 7 years old, I went down an aisle and I prayed a prayer. That's great, but how is your life different now? It's not. About when I was about 8, I quit going to church, and that's the last time I ever thought about it. And I spent an hour in the room with this guy, and I could never get him off the fact that when he was 7, he'd prayed a prayer. He'd made a decision. And that was what he was basing his whole eternity on. And I think sometimes we can have a sense of false assurance, false security, because at some point in time we were with a friend or in a service and made a decision. Another thing that might give people a sense of false assurance is church involvement. I go to church. I hang out in church. I love what Billy Sunday says about this. A great preacher named Billy Sunday said, going to church doesn't make you a Christian any more than going into a garage makes you a car. A person who is a follower of Jesus is not just somebody who goes to church. It's somebody who's given their whole life to Christ, okay? And church involvement, we can feel like, hey, I'm okay. I'm in. I'm good with God because I go to church or because I did the church things. I was baptized. I went to church a lot. I even went on a mission trip one time. Church involvement is not what should give us security, assurance. Another thing is that I was in maybe you grew up in a Christian family and you're like, I get Browning points with God because my dad was a deacon or my dad was a preacher or my dad went to church or my mom was involved. My mom worked in children's ministry. I have to be okay because of those things. And a lot of people can have a sense of false assurance, false security, because in their heart they think they're okay because they're part of the family plan. You know, it's kind of like insurance. If mom and dad are covered, I have to be too. The Bible doesn't know anything of that. I have to know Jesus for myself. Another way that I can get a sense of false assurance is through good works. If I'm just doing a lot of good stuff, God's got to scale, and he's got to be okay with me because, at least as far as I'm concerned, the stuff that I do that's good is better than the stuff that I do that's bad. The problem is that my good works will never be enough to take care of my deep inner problem of my sinfulness. But I may have jumped out of the airplane and feel like, hey, I'm okay because I do good stuff. I'm a good person. I help little old ladies across the street and, you know, that kind of stuff. And you know, that is a sense, can give you a sense of false security. Another thing is that I had an extraordinary experience. Maybe it was a baptism. Maybe it was you were in church one time and you got the warm fuzzies. Maybe you went somewhere and all of a sudden things were happening. All of a sudden you had this incredible experience. And because you had that experience, you're depending on that experience to give you security. I'm okay because I was in that church one time and something really cool happened, or I was on this at this camp. And what John wants us to wrestle with is this. The only way I can be sure that I have a relationship with God is to look at my life now and ask the question, does my life reflect having Christ in my heart? Do I, you know, is the way that things are happening for me today, does that really fit with the fact that I say I believe in Jesus? And as we wrestle with this, one of the key ideas that he brings up in a passage we're going to look at this morning is the idea that our practice ought to fit what we claim or who we have inside. The practice of our life ought to fit with that. Practice is kind of a crazy thing. There's a lot of stuff in life that I would have loved to have been good at. For example, I would have loved to have been a musician. I would have, you know, kind of like Quinn back here, you know, playing the drums. You know, and the problem is that no matter how hard I want to, you know, just because I have this incredible desire to be cool like Quinn, and I, you know... Well, okay, I made that part up. But anyway, you know, just sitting down at a set of drums isn't going to make me a drummer, partly because I'm way too white and I have no rhythm. But among other reasons, I've never practiced it. You ever play air guitar? I was awesome at air guitar, you know. Yeah. But I pick up a real guitar. If I picked up Nick's guitar, it would not be pretty, and then he'd be mad at me because his guitar is really expensive and really good, and I might break it, and I don't want to do something like that. But no matter how much in my heart right now I'd like to play guitar, my real problem is that I've never put any effort into playing guitar. Many of you have taken kids fishing. If you've been with a kid fishing for the first time, You get them this fishing rod, and it's not going to look anything like this because this is a fishing rod that somebody has to really work at. But if you've ever been with a kid, they take the fishing rod, and they're getting ready to cast it, and they throw it, and the lure goes that way. It's like, you know, and then next thing you know, they get this knot, and it's all tangled up, and you're like, oh my gosh, what are you going to do? And so you spend like your whole day with this kid fishing. You never get to cast your own rod because you spend the whole day getting their knots out, trading them rods as they tangle the next one. And eventually you got to tell the kid, hey, you know, if you want to be good at this, you're going to have to practice. Now, my understanding is that Perry and PJ Overton went through this. They went on a fishing trip recently, and the first day PJ was struggling, and Dad said, hey, listen, you need to practice your casting. And like the first day, Perry caught, you know, most of the fish. PJ didn't really catch a whole lot, but my understanding is by the second, third, and fourth day, PJ caught the biggest and the most fish. He put a lot of practice into it and really got good at it. Casting a rod can take a lot of work. You know, it seems like it's just simple, but if you've never done it before, you know, it actually is something you got to practice at to get halfway decent at. Basketball, you know, everybody's watching NCAA basketball, you know, stuff, and the whole basketball thing, you know. And it looks really cool to get out there. But one of the things that's going to happen is some team this week is going to lose a game because a guy steps to a line and he gets what's called a free throw, which means nobody is guarding him. He's going to step to that line, and he's going to take his time, and he's going to shoot. And when he shoots, it's going to go clank and bounce out. And the other team's going to get the rebound and win because he missed the free throw. In fact, this happened yesterday. Xavier lost a game because the guy with about 10 seconds left in the game missed a free throw that would have given them a 4-point lead. The other team came down, Ohio State, hit a 3-pointer at the buzzer. The game went in overtime. Xavier lost if he hits that free throw. But here's the thing. You know, these guys, you watch them just step up and you think, okay, these guys shooting free throws. You know, these guys spend hours. When you play college basketball, you shoot a minimum of 100 free throws a day. A minimum. Practice, 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 practice. There's a lot of things in life that we practice. We got a kid in our youth group, or in our group here, that has practiced juggling. Daniel, come on down. This is Daniel Bondurant, and Daniel has spent part of his life really practicing juggling. Now, I can juggle one thing at a time. If I add a second thing, I'm in big trouble, okay? I'm not coordinated. But Daniel's worked on it. Show us what you can do just real quick. Now, here's the deal. The rest of you, unless you've practiced this, if I had you come down and ask you to grab these things, you would grab them and the first one go up in the head, the air. You might catch the first one. The second one is going to hit you right on top of the head, right? I mean, I would be in trouble. I would break something if I did this. But Daniel has practiced. Thanks, Daniel. Good job, buddy. And see, here's the deal. As we talk about this morning, I want you to understand that as we're reading this passage, it talks a lot about practice, what we practice. Practice starts with this desire to do something, but then there's an application of my life to make it a reality so I can become good at it. Quinn practices the drums. Nick practices the guitar. There's people who sit down. There's a buddy of ours named John Davis who can sit down on a keyboard and he just make it sing. But they spend hours working at this. People practice shooting free throws. There's a guy named Blake Ahern who played at Missouri State who shot over 95% all 4 years of college on the free throw line. But he spent hours upon hours upon hours shooting free throws. And it takes a lot of effort. In the same way, what John is about to tell us in this passage is that in our lives, when we trust Jesus, there's going to be this desire to be like him. And that will come out in the way our practice, the practice of our lives works. That it's not going to be just like a guy who says, oh, I want to be a drummer. And so every once in a while, they sit down and just bang on drums with no rhythm. All of a sudden, there's a desire to work at it and become what I am on the inside and my life on the outside. And that's what John's about to say. If you have your Bibles, turn to 1 John chapter 2. And if you don't have a Bible, at the end of your row, we have Bibles for you. We'd love for you to take one. Just pass those Bibles down. If you're on the end of a row, even if you have a Bible, go ahead and pass them to the middle so that everybody can have a Bible. On that Bible, we'll be on page 878, and we're going to be reading out of 1 John chapter 2. We will begin with verse 28. We're going to be talking about practice, the test of practice. Does your life today reflect the fact that there is a attitude of practice in my life towards being right with God and living for him. That's what this passage is about. Chapter 2 and verse 28. He says this, "Now, little children, abide in him." That's such a key phrase in everything John writes. Abiding in him is this idea that I'm connected to Jesus and I'm holding on to him and I'm in a relationship and I'm not going to leave it. Abide in him. "So that when he appears, we may have confidence and not shrink back from him in shame at his coming. If you know that he is righteous, you may be sure that everyone who practices righteousness has been born of him. See what kind of love the Father has given to us, that we should be called children of God. And so we are. The reason why the world does not know us is that it did not know him. Beloved, we are God's children now. And what we will be has not appeared, but we know that when he appears, we will be like him, because we will see him as he is. And everyone who has this hope, who thus hopes in him, purifies himself as he is pure. Everyone who makes a practice of sinning also practices lawlessness. Sin is lawlessness. You know that he appeared to take away sins, and in him there is no sin. No one who abides in him keeps on sinning, and no one who keeps on sinning has either seen him or known him. Little children, let no one deceive you. Whoever practices righteousness is righteous, as he is righteous. Whoever makes a practice of sinning is of the devil, for the devil has been sinning from the beginning. The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil. No one born of God makes a practice of sinning, for God's seed abides in him, and he cannot keep on sinning because he has been born of God. By this it is evident who are the children of God and who are the children of the devil. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is the one who does not love his brother." Did you see the number of times that the word practice and righteousness were mentioned? We'll get to that in a minute, but that's the key idea. He's saying, listen, your practice, if you truly have trusted Jesus, you've truly have given him your life, the practice of your life is going to demonstrate that in some way. And that's what we're really going to wrestle with this morning. He starts in the very first verse. In verse 28, he says, "Now, little children, abide in him so that when he appears, we may have confidence and not shrink back from him in shame at his coming." This is kind of a prompter. He says, listen, there's going to be a day when the parachute's got to open. The day of his appearing. It's talking about the fact that all of the Bible teaches that Jesus is coming back someday. And when he comes back, at that point in time, that's it. Now, there's two ways that Jesus can come back for us. He can come back for us in our death, or he can come back maybe in our lifetime. It might be possible that his return literally takes place. But either way, it is at that point in time that we have to be sure that we have the parachute on. But here's the deal. None of us knows when that's going to happen. And he says, when that takes place, there are going to be some people who felt secure, who felt okay. They felt like, hey, I'm good. But when they come to this point, they are going to realize that they literally have shame before God, and they are going to shrink back from him in shame. They're going to hide themselves and run from Jesus, because at that point, they're going to realize, I did not prepare for this point in time. There's other people who it says here that will have confidence before him. Not confidence like, Jesus, I'm cool, look at me. Confidence because they've trusted Jesus. They've been in a relationship with him. And because they've trusted Jesus and they're in a relationship with him, they now feel comfortable to approach him, to speak freely, to be comfortable with Jesus. Not because of themselves, but because what he's done in their lives. We were this week in Super Smokers. We like Super Smokers. And so we went into Super Smokers. And in Super Smokers, they have on one of the walls the skull of a bull. It's kind of scary looking. It's got the horns, and it's just, you know, looks like something out of some creepy show, you know. It's hanging on a wall. We were in there, and my two-year-old son, Josiah, looked up and saw that and kind of freaked out. He's getting, you know, we're clear at the other end of the restaurant, but he could not take his eyes off of it. He just kept looking at this skull on the wall. He kept saying, I scared. And so, like good parents, we thought, how do you deal with fear? You confront fear head on. And so we said, let's go look at it. Okay, Josiah, let's go look at this. And so we got him out of his seat, and he was a little nervous, but he's like, okay. And we convinced him the best way to deal with this is to confront your fears, right? Because we're good parents. That's the way you deal with fear, right? And so we started walking, and he's walking really daintily towards this skull. And we think if we just get him there and see that, hey, everything's okay, he will come to a point where he has a little confidence before. It's not scary for him. And so he's walking real slowly. But what happened was, while he could not take his eyes off the skull, he walks into a table. And he thought it had got him. He did. He hit that table and he burst into tears, ran back. Ah! He is screaming. He is crying. He is utterly, I mean, you could see it in his eyes. He is utterly terrified. And he is shaking. We put him back. I'm holding him. And he is still, he cannot take his eyes off this skull. He cannot break with this. But now that terror is so much deeper because he thinks that thing somehow got him. You know, and he is just a basket case. I have to take him outside, but guess what? To take him outside, I got to walk right past that skull. And so taking him outside, he's shaking and fighting me, and he's just terrified. This is what John's saying. The appearing of Jesus is really a beautiful thing. There are going to be some people who think they got it all together. And then Jesus shows up, and at that moment, they're going to run in terror because they come to a point where they realize that they weren't ready for this. And John wants us to be prepared. He wants us to know the life-changing power of Jesus, both for blessing in this life, but so that when that day comes, we can have confidence, not shrink back in terror, not shrink back in horror, not be afraid of this, but we look forward to the coming of Jesus. And John is helping us wrestle with some of the things, and one of those things is the practice of our life. He says, listen, we need to understand, if you know that God is righteous, verse 29, if you know that God is righteous, then the one who knows that will practice righteousness. There's two key terms here, and I just want to, for a minute, wrestle with these two key terms because they are really key to unlocking this entire passage. The first term is the idea of righteousness, and the second is the idea of practicing or doing what it says. He says, listen, the one who knows that God is righteous will practice righteousness. And if I just read this, first of all, we don't even use the word in our culture. Nobody talks about righteousness unless it's like, whoa, that was righteous, dude. You know, I mean, we don't really use the term righteous other than, you know, some slang term. But it is one of the most important words in all of the Bible. It is a word that is from cover to cover in Scripture. From the beginning of Scriptures, God told his people, I expect righteousness from you. God declares that I am a righteous God. And that righteousness is the standard. And the basic idea, the word comes from this idea of a straight reed, something they would use to measure with. It's an image of a measuring stick. It's I'm up on a roof working on a world changers project, okay? And we've kind of measured things out, and we realize that we're going to need 62-inch boards to fit from here to here. And I need a 62-inch board. And so I hollered down to this person on the ground, get me a 62-inch board. And so they whip out this, you know, 8-foot measuring tape, you know, and they whip out the little Black and Decker, and if it's really cool, it's even got the little thing that stops it, and it's, you know, real dirt, you know, starting. They start measuring out boards, and all of a sudden they pull a board, and this board is only 54 inches long. It does not live up to the dimensions that are needed. It is not a righteous board because it doesn't fit the measurement that was needed for this situation. And so all of a sudden we start measuring boards. How tragic it would be if we were trying to rebuild a roof if none of our boards were 62 inches long. We would be in desperate trouble. We wouldn't be able to complete this. Well, this is what the Bible talks about righteousness. It says God is righteous. He is the standard by which we measure ourselves against. And his demand of us is to live up to that standard if we're going to be in a relationship with our Creator. And so there is the righteousness of God. But in that expectation, there is the realization that while he needs a 62-inch board, none of us ever live up to that. And in Romans chapter 3, it says this. There's none, as is written, no one is righteous, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside, together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. This is the idea. God says, this is my standard. I am righteous, I'm perfect, I am holy, I'm a great God. And I call people into a relationship with myself based on that standard. But when the measuring tape is pulled out, nobody lives up to that standard. Nobody is righteous. And so God sent Jesus, who was perfect, who was righteous, to become our righteousness. And what God did is he took the righteousness of Jesus and he put it into our account. It's called imputed righteousness. Look at this passage here. It says, for our sake, he made him, Jesus, to be sin, who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. This is what it's saying. God expects righteousness, but nobody lives up to that measurement. And so God sent Jesus. He was righteous. He did live up to God's expectation. And what God has done for you and for me is that God has placed into the person who has trusted Jesus, who's given their life to Jesus, God has placed into them his righteousness. It means miraculously God took 58-inch boards and made them 62 inches. Now, you can't see, you know, we had a kid, this was hilarious. We sent a kid around on this chase at a world change. We're on this mission project, 4 different houses on the same roof, you know, people are up on roofs, you know, putting boards in and stuff. And there's this one kid who, you know, maybe a little bit annoying to people. And so they sent him on this wild goose chase looking for a board stretcher. And he went to each site going, my crew chief has sent me to find a board stretcher. Do you have one? Well, they told him, well, we'll give you our board stretcher if you'll go get somebody else's left-handed hammer. And this kid spent like all afternoon one day walking around looking for a board stretcher. Guess what? There's no such thing. You can't take a 58-inch board and make it 62 inches. And see, this is what Christ has done in our life. Christ has taken something that was not righteous and put righteousness in it. That's me. I don't live up to God's standard. Do not read this passage and read, practice being good. That's not the issue. I can practice goodness a lot and never know Jesus. What he says is I have to practice righteousness, which means I have to be right first with God before I can do what is right. But God, through Jesus, has made people right with him if they trust him, if they give their lives to him. Now I have righteousness. And he says, listen, therefore, what ought to happen in my life, I have this imputed, this righteousness that was credited to my bank account, but now it ought to show up in my life. The practice of my life ought to reflect what's been done on the inside of me. He says, practice righteousness. Well, anything I practice, I mean, it doesn't matter what, if I want to play piano, if I want to become a good ball player, if I want to be good at the drums or guitar or juggling, some things have to be there. First of all, I really have to have a level of ability, okay? You know, for some of us, let's be honest, it doesn't matter how long and how hard we practice, we're never going to get to the point where we're going to be able to play NCAA basketball or play a guitar like Nick. We just don't have the skill, right? And so there has to be a level of ability that is there. But also as we wrestle with what it means to practice, there also has to be a goal that is in mind. We have to see that eventually we are aiming for something. This image, you know, you don't start picking up the guitar and playing just because you think it's a cool thing. Eventually you want to be able to do it with the real guitar, which you've always done with an air guitar, right? You know? And there has to be this goal, this outcome that you're working towards. It's a piano person who starts taking piano lessons who loves the music of Mozart can't come anywhere near playing, but one day I want to be able to play that song. And not only that, there has to be a level of commitment or dedication. There has to be practice that goes along with it. And in this passage, the second we talk about righteousness, there's also the idea of practicing. And the word practicing all through this text is just the word for do. But it's the tense of the word all the way through that matters. He says, listen, those who do sin are sinners. Those who do righteousness are righteous. And there's really no really middle ground, but the tense of the word is more than just committing sin. Listen, I sin every day. John even affirms it in John chapter 1. He says, listen, if you claim that you're without sin, you're really lying and you're making God a liar. We sin. But the idea through this practice is not that I have this individual time where I sin. The idea of practice all the way through here is that I work at it. I want to be good at it. You know, and there are a lot of people out there who they want to be really good at sin. They really want to be good at, you know, they want to become the best in the world at, you know, the things that are against the perfect love of Christ. But he says those who have Christ in their heart, what's going to happen is that over time, there's going to be a life change where all of a sudden you begin to see Jesus and trust him and it becomes real in your life. And as Christ is real in your life, the practice of your life will reflect a change of heart. All right? Does that make sense to you? Yes? I hope so, because what he eventually says is, listen, the person who practices righteousness, this is how we know if somebody has Jesus in their life. There is a practice in their life that reflects the righteousness that's on the inside. Doesn't mean that I'm going to be perfect, but it means that there is a change in the way kind of my life comes out. And that's what John says. And kind of there's three areas that I want to focus on as we look at this, three areas that will reflect the practice that will go on in my life. And the first one is this. The first thing that is a reality is this, that my ability has become a real issue in my righteousness. I have become righteous. I am the righteousness of God. That's what the Bible says about anybody who's trusted Jesus. If you have Christ in your life today, God has made you right with himself. You have a relationship with God. In chapter 3, verse 1, look at this. He says, see what kind of love the Father has given to us that we should be called children of God. Listen, no matter how long I work, especially now that I'm round, I am not going to have the ability physically, and as an old dude, to compete with 22-year-old NCAA basketball players. When I was in college, I played college baseball, and I loved baseball. I worked my tail off at baseball. I actually was decent on a college level. There was points in time where I had scouts even looking at me, and that was kind of cool and exciting. I went to a couple professional Major League Baseball tryout camps, and I had good baseball stuff as a pitcher. But my problem was that my fastball, a lot of you, this won't mean anything if you're not a baseball fan, but if you are, you'll understand. My fastball topped out about 82 miles an hour. The average major league fastball is 90 miles an hour, okay? And so there was a big difference between my ability and the ability of people who play pro baseball. And like running speed and quickness and things, how hard you throw a ball is kind of something you're born with. You can improve a little bit, but you can't take a guy who throws 82 and make him throw 95 unless you're the rookie, right? Seen that movie, all right? The rest of us, you're kind of stuck with this. You don't take people who run, 5'8", 40s, work with them for 2 weeks, and now they're running 4'6". You don't take people who can't play Mary Had a Little Lamb on a piano and give them 2 weeks with a keyboard and some music, and next thing you know, they're, playing everything. You just don't do that. There has to be some ability there. And what God is saying here, what John is saying here, is that when you gave your life to Christ, before that you could not live up to God's standard, but now he has literally made you children of God. He's made you his own family. He has called you his children, and he has put his stuff into you. And now you couldn't be what God expected before, but guess what? He has called you his child. If you're a follower of Jesus, that's what he said about you. He's called you his child, and he has taken the person who didn't have the ability to honor him and please him, and now has made him part of his family. I love the word here. Actually, the word where it says, that what great love the Father has for us. The word what great love is the idea of it's from another country. It's like, it is so good. God's love for us is so incredible. It's almost otherworldly. It's almost like not even of this planet. It is so incredible. That is how incredible God's love to call us his children, to bring us into a relationship with himself when we didn't deserve it, to love us and to give us the ability that we didn't have. He said, what kind of love is this that we would be called the children of God? You think about your kids, and one thing about kids, especially when they're young, is that there's this real deep desire to be like mom and dad, and they even look like it. My little 2-year-old Josiah walks around and he even waddles like I waddle. It's pathetic. I ran into a guy this week that my dad knew for 40 years. I mean, knew from when I was way, even before I was born. And I ran into him. I got a chance to talk to him a little bit, and he didn't know me, but he knows my dad really well. Now, I've met the guy a couple times, but he didn't really know who I was. But as soon as I walked up, some people took me. Brian actually brought me over to introduce this guy named John MacArthur. And as I walked up to him, he goes, hey, you look just like your dad. I mean, you're a spitting image of Hub, which is what everybody calls my dad. I mean, there's just kind of this deal in us that our genetics and even our desire, we want to be like our parents. And you see it in your little kids, and it's beautiful. And guess what? This is what John's saying. God has placed in you himself, and now all of a sudden we are children of God, and we start looking like our Father. We have this ability that wasn't there before to be righteous, to practice righteousness. Now, if I take my little 2-year-old out and we like start working in the yard and I give him one of those little plastic rakes, he may mimic me, but he's not going to be able to do the things that I do. He's got a lot of growing to do, but there's already ways that he resembles his father. In the same way, you and I may be early in our Christian walk, and the way it looks may not be complete and developed, but all of a sudden, the practice of our life, we all of a sudden want to live out what Christ has put into us. And it may be in little ways, but it's there. And over a period of a lifetime, you begin to see changes that are affected this way. But now all of a sudden, righteousness can come out in my life, this standard, this way God desires us to live, because on the inside, he's made me righteous. There's ability. Second thing is that there's an aim. There's an aim to this. If I want to become good at something, listen, I have to work at it. There has to be a goal in mind. There has to be an aim. I'm not going to become a good guitarist or a good bass player up here like Alex unless I have this idea of what it's going to sound like when I work at it. One of the things about being a great free throw shooter is that you have to really learn exactly what to focus on. There has to be this really desired outcome before you even pick up the basketball. And, do you remember... guys are like this. I spent hours, with a tennis ball, throwing a ball off the wall because in my mind, even at 8 years old, I saw myself playing for the baseball Cardinals. And that aim, that focus of this, what I want to become someday, consumed my effort, my work. And so I really found it to be a joy to do most of the work, the hard stuff that went into practicing baseball. The same way I imagine Nick when he spends the time playing the guitar or others who play musical instruments or Daniel when he's juggling, they have these images of what it really looks like if they really perfected this. And that's what he's about to say. Look at this passage. Look at what he says. Verse 2. He says, "Beloved, we are now God's children, and what we will be has not yet appeared, but we know that when he appears, we'll be like him because we will see him as he is. And everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself as he is pure." Here it is. Jesus is coming back. We don't know what it's going to be like. We don't know what it's going to look like. We don't really, here we are 2,000 years later. We don't even know what Jesus looks like. I doubt if he's going to show up as a blue-eyed guy with, brown feathered hair. Which is the way we kind of picture him in pictures, But Jesus is going to return. We know some things about Jesus after the resurrection. For example, we know that he was tangible. He told his disciples, "Put your hands here. Put your hands at my side. Touch my feet. See that I am really the risen Savior." We know that he ate fish. He went out and had breakfast, had fish and bread one morning with his disciples. We know that he was had this body that was very real, but it was also a body that was above the natural. It was a supernatural body. But beyond that, we don't know a whole lot about what Jesus was like. But we do know this. Someday he's coming back. And what it says here is when that happens, when Jesus returns, at that moment, if I am a follower of Jesus, if I have confidence in him, I'm going to be like him. Because I'm going to see him the way he really is. I'm going to come to the point at that moment that my life, I will be resurrected to a new way of life, a new feeling. I'm going to be like Jesus. But here's the goal. Here's the aim. If you're a follower of Jesus, here's the deal. I want to, right now, the distance between where I am and being like Jesus is like way over here and way over here. But my life as a Christian is that every day I'm taking a little step, a little closer to that, so that the gap is closed, so that the transformation that takes place in me when Jesus returns is a lot less than it would be if he came right now. Does that make sense? And so a person who is a follower of Jesus, that's kind of the aim of our life. We want to be like Jesus. We don't know everything that's going to be like, but here's the deal. Every day I get a little closer to what that means. Every day I grow closer to him and become a little more like him. There's going to be a day when I am completely like him. That will not happen on this earth. But the transformation that takes place on that day, I hope, is not a huge one, because every day of my life I've become a little more like Jesus. And I have this aim. I want to be like Jesus. Therefore, I'm practicing. The righteousness of God is coming out in my life. John says, we don't know what it's totally going to be like, but we know this. When he appears, we're going to be like him. And so, everyone who has this hope that Jesus is coming back, I'm going to be like him. If you have that hope in you, if you have that aim in your life, it purifies you. That's a process of the outside you becoming more like the righteousness that is already in you. Purifies himself. And so there's this aim, there's this ability. God's giving me this ability to be what he wants me to be because he's placed his son in my life. I now have this aim that I'm going to become like Jesus, but there also has to be action in my life. There has to be action. Verses 4 and following, he says, everyone who makes a practice of sinning also practices lawlessness, for sin is lawlessness. You know that he appeared to take away sins, and in him there is no sin. No one who abides in him keeps on sinning, and no one who keeps sinning has either seen him or known him. There's this now, okay, so I have, God's given me his righteousness because I've trusted him. And God has also given me a new aim in life, and hopefully I'm focused on that aim, but now it's going to start showing up in the things that I practice. Do I practice righteousness or the things that, you know, God's purpose and plan, and, you know, this isn't a list. It is that Christ in me gives me desires and I live those things out. Or is my practice really reflective of the fact that what I really like to be good at is being a heathen and just self-serving and living for me? He says, listen, the one who practices righteousness, that's the guy who's righteous. The one who practices sinning, that's the one that really shows what's on the inside. Because what's on the inside of you eventually is going to show up on the outside. You know, so here's this guy who, all of a sudden he says, man, I knew this guy once, and he was a Christian, right? He was a cool Christian dude, but, you know, he didn't go to church, and he didn't, you know, like, do anything for God, and he didn't really love Jesus, but he was a Christian, and, you know, he was like the biggest party animal, woohoo, you know, that I knew, but he was a Christian, right? Well, was he? I knew this duck once that it didn't have a bill, and it didn't float, and it didn't have feathers and wings. It's not a duck. It's just not a duck, okay? Just because somebody claims to be a Christian, eventually somebody who's a follower of Jesus, the practice of their life is going to reflect what's going on the inside. I'm just going to be kind of honest with you. I know a lot of people have spent their life in church, but the practice of their life has never shown that they have a real relationship with their Creator. And if that's you, you need to wrestle with not how do I go be better. You need to wrestle with have I really trusted Jesus yet? That's the deal, okay? And so John says a couple things. He says, you know, your practice will demonstrate what you value. In verse 4, 5, and 6, he talks about this where he says, listen, the person who practices sinning is practicing lawlessness, for sin is lawlessness. And the idea of lawlessness is just this heart of rebellion that says, you know, in the end, I don't really care what God wants. I'm doing my own thing. You know, if that's the real attitude of your heart, if you're kind of like, okay, I prayed the prayer and I'm forgiven, I can do whatever I want to for the rest of my life. What John is saying is, wait a minute, that's not really the right value that somebody who has Christ in their life will hold. Because the person who values Jesus will value that relationship in a great way, and it will change them, all right? And so, what you practice really demonstrates what you value. What you practice also demonstrates who you follow. In verse 8, John's one of these guys. If you're kind of a gray area person, if you like, you know, gray areas, John's going to make you uncomfortable because he is like one of the most black and white people on the planet, okay? It's like you're either this or this. And look at what he says in verse 8. He says, whoever makes a practice of sinning is of the devil. How do you like that? You're of the devil. The red horns, and that's who you are. That ought to make you a little uncomfortable. He says, listen, if the attitude of your life is I'm a sinner and I'm good at it, you're following the one who set the tone for that, man. The devil's the best, and you're right there in his footsteps. On the other hand, if your life is one that shows that you are practicing righteousness, you're of the Father. You know, what you practice really demonstrates who you follow. And the third thing he says here is your practice demonstrates what's on the inside. Look at verse 9. He says this, no one born of God makes a practice of sinning, for God's seed abides in him, and he cannot keep on sinning because he has not been born of God. Now, as you read this passage, some of you probably are going, but wait a minute, I still sin. And I still have habits that hold me. I hate them. I don't want anybody to know about him. I struggle. I don't know how to let go. And some of you are saying, but hold on, if I compare myself to like somebody who's a priest or a pastor or somebody like that, I'm like not very far in this. How do I deal with that? And this is what John is saying. John is saying what God did is he placed his, if you have trusted Christ and he's changed your life, God has placed a seed on the inside of you. And that seed is planted in good soil. It will begin to grow. But a little bitty oak sapling and a 50-year-old oak tree are going to look different in the journey of that. But if a seed is in you, it's going to show up. Do you see what he's saying there? He doesn't say that God has placed this full-grown tree or this full-grown plant. He said God has placed a seed in you. A seed has to take root and then has to grow. But eventually that seed, you know, if you went out to a farm field right now, if it had just been freshly planted, you'd just see dirt. But underneath the dirt, something is going on because seeds have been planted in there. And now a little bit of water, a little bit of rain, eventually there's going to be some roots growing. And over a period of next few weeks, if you went back to that same field, you wouldn't have seen what happened every day. But all of a sudden, you're going to see that all of a sudden there's like little corn plants that are this big. They will show themselves because the seed was already in the ground. You go back in a month and the corn is going to be this tall. And you go back in 2 months and all of a sudden you have this big, tall, green corn and it just grew up. And this is what he's saying. People are at different stages of this journey. We get that. But if Christ is in your life, he has placed a seed on the inside of you. And a person who has Christ in their life, this is what will happen. The practice of their life will change over time because there is a seed on the inside of you that will cause that to happen. In verse 10, he eventually says, listen, this is how you know. How do you know if somebody is a believer or not? How do you know if somebody has their parachute and all that? If there is a practice of righteousness, this desire where I now have a new ability, God's Christ is in me, my life focus is changing. And now there's this desire that I really want to be like Jesus. I really want to grow in that. And my life practice is changing. That person has Christ. A person who walked an aisle, said a prayer, had a religious experience, but their life practice is sinfulness, just rebellion, and I'm going to do my own thing, and I'm going to be good at it. That person probably doesn't have the seed in their life. That's how you know the difference. And John is just saying, hey, man, make sure. If your practice does not fit, I was talking to somebody this week and just kind of asked the question, how do you know? How do you know you're a believer? How do you know you have Jesus in your life? I love the answer. The answer was this. Because my life is different today than it was a few years ago. I don't do some of the things I used to do. I don't do some of the things I used to do. And some things I do now, I would have never thought I'd have done them before. There it is. Practice of righteousness. I'm not perfect. I'm not like Jesus yet. But man, there is a sense which I know that I'm on the journey. And that seed is growing up on the inside of me. That's what John says here, man. Our practice has to fit it. But here's the deal. Here's the bottom line. All of this is about Jesus. I just want to close with that because there's three ideas in here that he talks about as we talk about the fact that none of this is me going and doing the best I can for myself. It is all tethered to the fact that Jesus has changed my life and the fact that Jesus has, he did come, he came. Twice John says, and this is why Jesus came. First he says, Jesus came to take away your sin. That's what, when Jesus came, he lived on this earth and he did that to take away your sin, to take away the part of you, to give forgiveness. This guy named John sees Jesus. He says, there's the Lamb of God. He's going to take away the sin of the world. Jesus came to take away our sin. It also says that Jesus came to destroy the works of the devil. Jesus came to overcome the evil one. He came, he died on a cross for you and for me. He gave his life so that we could have righteousness. He came, but he also comes. Jesus came and passed, but he comes. He comes into people's lives. He changes them from the inside out. He places his seed in their heart. He gives them righteousness. He calls them his children. He still comes. And if you're not a follower of Jesus, if you're kind of checking Jesus out and you're not sure what to do with it, I just want to tell you that Jesus will change your life from the inside out. If you trust him, he will come into your life. He will change you. But he's also coming. He's coming again. The You know, the word here is where it talks about when he appears, when he comes in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 3. It is a word that is used for when a king, a regent shows up in a community. And the idea is here comes the king and everybody stops and takes notice because when the king shows up, it's a big deal. Jesus is coming again. It's all about Jesus. It is all about Jesus. I cannot be righteous. I can't take a 52-inch board or a 58-inch board and make it 62 inches. But Jesus gave his life to change me and do that for me. And so even today, we're going to celebrate communion. The celebration of communion is a time for us to really stop and focus on the fact that everything about my practice is about Jesus. It's not about me trying to be better so I can get God's attention. It's about the fact that Jesus came, gave his life for me. He comes into my heart, and he's coming again, and I can look forward to that. Literally, as we do communion, what we do is we celebrate the fact that Jesus' body was broken for us, that he gave his life on the cross, that his blood was spilled out to forgive my sin, that Jesus took my place, that I was unrighteous, and I didn't deserve God's love and grace, but he gave his love and grace anyway through Jesus. You may be here today, and maybe you're sitting here, and you're like, all right, I hear all this, but I'm going to be real honest. My practice doesn't live up to that. Or maybe you're just like, you're not really even sure about this whole Jesus thing, and you've got questions. I want to tell you, I'd be more than happy to stand around and chit-chat with you about those and what all that means. If you're a follower of Jesus, as we have communion in the next few minutes, we just want to invite you to participate as a time to remember what Jesus did for you. And just to celebrate the fact that he has done for you what you couldn't do on your own. But it's also time just for a moment to examine yourself and say, hey, where's my practice? Because the most miserable person in the world is a person who is a follower of Jesus, but they're going through a period of their life where their practice is not living up to who they really are. Maybe today you just need to be real honest with God and go, you know what? I need to grow in the journey. I need to come back to where my aim and my focus is right. Wherever you are, we just want to encourage you. There's offering baskets are up here. If you want to worship through giving, if you're a guest, this service is our gift to you. We really don't expect you to give or want you to. And you may be here and feel uncomfortable doing communion. That's cool. This is not something that's required. But if you feel comfortable and you're a follower of Jesus, this time is for you to remember what Jesus did for you. I'm going to pray. Band's going to lead us as we sing. Stand with us after that. And when God lead you to, just come down and participate. Jesus, we love you. I praise you for being everything to us, and I praise you for your righteousness, and I praise you that our life can reflect what you want. So I just pray that this morning you'll move in our life in that way. As we celebrate communion, Lord, help us be awed by the incredible gift of your sacrifice. In your name I pray. Amen.